Yes, thank you very much for this warm welcome and for the introduction. I'm Ann, and I'm super excited to be here today and have this stage for 40 minutes or so to introduce you to the world of DNA information technology. I am currently a postdoc at the Institute for Chemical and Bioengineering at ETH Zurich. However, my employer is not directly sponsoring my being here today, and the focus of my talk will be much broader. I will be talking about some of the research that my colleagues and I were involved in, but otherwise I'll really mostly focus on the digital perspective of chemistry and argue that perhaps chemistry has been an information science all along. And I'll start with a brief crash course in DNA and DNA information technology, just to familiarize you with some of the basic concepts, and also delve a bit into the history and the different aspects of this field. And then for the second part of the talk, I will focus a bit more on security-related applications that we can realize in DNA. However, I think my overall goal today is really to inspire you to look at DNA or perhaps biomolecules in general from a different angle, as you've maybe never seen it before. Now, if we want to talk about DNA information technology, maybe we should start by looking at DNA. And I don't know about all of you, but I was introduced to this molecule in high school. And I remember my teacher telling us that DNA is the blueprint of life. And in this blueprint function, it stores the building plans of proteins in a sequence of four so-called nucleobases, A, C, T, and G. And these bases form what we call Watson-Crick base pairs. So A always binds to T, C to G, and vice versa. And so we can imagine this like two parts of the same molecules, or strands, as we call them, that are like puzzle pieces to each other. And together, these two opposite running strands form the beautiful 3D double helix that you probably all know. And I promise this is already the most chemical slide today, and it's really just important to me to cover some of the basics before we start. But I think an even broader perspective of looking at DNA is not just in terms of a blueprint, but perhaps even a source code. Because DNA doesn't simply store building plans, but it also contains regulatory elements that guide the process of life, kind of like instructions. And only if the code is read in the proper timing and the correct sequence, the complex feedback loops arise that in the end form and sustain life. And I think we have to be a bit careful here as well with these analogies and metaphors, because at some point they always break down, and there are people arguing or using this language to justify views of intelligent design, and this is obviously not where I'm going with this. But I do think that looking at life as a chemical information processing system can really help us asking some interesting questions. For example, can we perhaps remove DNA from its biological environment and create artificial DNA to write our own data and programs? And this question is actually not that new. So one of the first records I'm aware of someone asking this was by famous physicist Richard Feynman in a lecture in the 50s. And it took a lot of technological leaps in the meantime. But nowadays, I can already spoil that. I think with some caveats, we can answer this question with a yes. And here I also want to emphasize that it's not mainly about taking genomic or biologically sourced DNA and somehow editing it, but really synthesizing it in a lab and using it as a material for information processing purposes, just in the same way as we use silicon as a material for the same purpose. So now, maybe you're wondering, okay, maybe we can do this, but why should we? So with all this information technology we already have available today, why research a completely different system? And I think there, DNA really has some unique points going for itself. First of all, this is durability. So you can see here a horse bone dated from about 700,000 years ago. And scientists were able to, even after all this time, retrieve and read out this horse's genome. So this tells us that under the proper conditions and in the right matrix, DNA can really stand the test of time, even for geological ages. And as chemists in the lab, we can artificially create these conditions. So we can, for instance, generate fossils by encapsulating DNA in nanometer scale glass beads, and that way also preserve it for extended periods of time, for thousands, ten thousands, who knows, perhaps even up to billions of years. The second point is, with DNA, we don't really have to rethink the way we see information all that much. Because just as with digital information, DNA stores data in a sequence, and basically all we have to do is translate between a base 2 and a base 4. So we can just assign 2 bits per base, and that way translate back and forth between digital or binary information and DNA. The third point I want to mention is a bit more relevant for computation than data storage, and that is the option or the possibilities of parallelism. Because if you think about even a tiny drop of water, there are so many molecules in there, and in the case of DNA, each of these molecules can potentially be its own processor that does or performs calculations on its own simultaneously and independent from the others. And that offers opportunities for parallel operations that are just not possible in the same way using traditional computing. Now, if we talk parallelism, that also leads me to the point of density, information density. And the way I always like to introduce this is by thinking of my own body. Because as you're probably aware, almost every cell of our bodies contains a copy of our genome. And in the case of our bodies, I mean, nature is really crazy about backups, so every single cell contains the same information. However, if we ignore this redundancy and simply think about the number of bits that are contained in our entire body in the form of DNA, do you have any guesses how much information that would amount to? Just shout it out. Any idea? Some benchmark? Yes. 100 gigabytes. Do we have any higher bits? Yes. A few exabytes, yes, already closer. Higher bits even. Yes. Yeah, I think you're pretty close there. You're pretty close there. So we're actually talking around about 60 zettabytes. And that is in a single human body, considering that most of our mass is definitely not DNA. Or to put it in a different perspective, this is roughly the amount of digital data created in the year 2020. And as a Swiss, I tend to measure everything in chocolate. So all of these data could fit in the volume of a single bar of chocolate. So with these numbers, you can imagine that people are getting excited about DNA as a storage medium. But all of this is not very relevant if we're not able to actually process the information as well. And there, we are using functions that were also kindly developed for us by nature. And together with the tools that we have available in the lab as chemists, we can then, for example, write and copy DNA by synthesizing it. We can read it in a process we call sequencing. And there are a few other functions, such as, for example, deletion or editing. And I want to quickly zoom in into one of these important enzymatic reactions that we commonly use. So you probably know PCR, the latest since COVID testing. However, it was already an incredibly important tool for us lab scientists working with DNA. And we can, again, abstract this kind of like a function that contains three main instructions. First, the DNA double strand is split into single strands. And then we add something that we call primers. So these are short DNA segments themselves, and they kind of perform a search algorithm in the pool of templates available. And due to this Watson-Crick complementary base pairing mechanism, they will find their matching puzzle piece in this pool, bind it, and this will then recruit the enzyme called polymerase, which then copies the part of the DNA that lies in between the two primer binding regions. And importantly, this is an exponential process. So each step doubles the amount of DNA, and the reaction runs either until the reagents are depleted, or more typically, we define a number of cycles we go through. And so you can kind of understand this like a chemical for loop that just loops through these cycles and then copies all the DNA strands that match the primer regions. So with these tools available and explained, I think we're ready to store our first data in DNA. And on paper, the process is pretty straightforward. We start with encoding, so the translation process. Then we synthesize the DNA in the lab. We can amplify, copy it, and distribute it if we want to. We can store it for extended periods of time. And if we want to read it, we sequence it and then decode back to binary. And as I said, this sounds simple enough, right? In practice, however, this is still pretty tedious and expensive. However, in the past few years, we've really seen a lot of progress. So some major players have entered the game, such as Microsoft and Seagate. Some of these IT companies even have their own teams working on this. And these industry efforts, together with academic research, have now made things such as random access, error correction, and optimized encoding possible. However, despite this, I think most projects that we see implemented today are more kind of in the arts or PR sphere. Actually, the very first information stored in DNA was by an artist called Joe Davis. You can see it down here. So this Strichmännchen was encoded in DNA. Or in the bottom right, you can see a major streaming service who stored one of their bio-related TV shows in DNA. And my lab actually also collaborated with the band Massive Attack to store some of their music in DNA. And this DNA was then mixed into a can of spray paint, which was then in turn used to paint the album cover of the re-release of Mezzanine. And this kind of leads me to another interesting property of DNA. Because as a molecule, we can integrate DNA into materials. And that way, we can embed object-bound metadata. So, and it's also compatible with some types of 3D printing. So, for example, in an object like this, we could actually store data. And the first time this was scientifically done, to my knowledge, was by a colleague and friend of mine. He actually stored an STL print file into DNA, and then embedded this DNA into the printing filament, manufactured the bunny, and then from a tiny little piece of the bunny's ears, he was able to extract the DNA and print more bunnies from this. And I mean, I think it's a really cool and fun project, and it's also kind of a meta comment on DNA. However, it also has some practical applications. Because if you think of objects with a very long lifetime, such as buildings or public infrastructure, it can be really challenging to keep the data and metadata on these objects for an extended period of time. And that way, we would be able to solve that by simply integrating this information directly into the building materials. Now, so far, I've mainly talked about data storage, and I just want to take a quick detour over DNA computing. I'll keep that part very short, but I picked out some projects that I think are really interesting, and one of the first ones that really gained traction was done by famous computer scientist Leonard Adleman, so the same guy you may know from RSA encryption, and he solved the Hamiltonian path problem in non-exponential time using DNA. And then a few years later, the first logic gates were implemented in DNA. And then still in the 90s, a group of researchers from the US demonstrated in a proof of concept that they would be able to break the data encryption standard. And back then, this was a 56-bit key, and they presented a DNA algorithm where they would be able to solve this in a fraction of the time as opposed to a computer at that period. And I think I deliberately picked these three problems because they are also kind of the basis for more security-related DNA applications. And like most good science, these things were already covered by Star Trek a while before they were actually implemented in real life. In this case, it was an episode in The Next Generation, and in the plot, there is an ancient species who stored a program in DNA and then hid different parts or fragments of this program across the galaxy and sort of made it a scavenger hunt. And only if all of these fragments were reassembled, the program would run and then tell the stories of this long extinct species. So this kind of covers DNA data storage. It also covers computation, but it also introduces the idea of steganography, so hiding information in DNA. And something like this was done a few years later, where a team of researchers stored this famous message from Second World War in DNA, and then hid it in a huge background of random or kind of random dummy DNA. And in order to retrieve it or amplify it over this background, you would need to know the PCR primer sequences to get back the original message. And this was kind of the starting point for DNA cryptography. And ever since, many more projects have been implemented. I want to introduce you to just one more here, which I think is pretty interesting because it combines biometric data with synthetic DNA. And what they did here was read a person's STR profile. So this is a highly variable region in the genome, which is very individual to each and every person. And from that, entropy can be extracted to generate an 80-bit encryption key. And this key was then used to encode ciphertext, which was then stored in DNA. And to retrieve the clear text, you would sequence the biometric data again together with the synthetic DNA and then get the original back. Now, this system, it can be argued that it has a few weaknesses. And one of them is that the entropy, 80 bits, that's not that much, especially considering that you have to read quite a lot of DNA for this system. And in fact, we have a much more efficient random generator available. And that is DNA synthesis. So in a single reaction, we're able, by combining the four bases, to generate huge amounts of randomness in a single reaction environment, and you can see some numbers here. So we can generate hundreds of petabytes worth of randomness for below 100 euros. And the contrast here is that for a sequence designed, defined synthesis, we also need the same reaction environment. So there is a huge asymmetry in cost from which we can benefit when we produce random DNA. Now that we have all this randomness available, what do we do with it? And that was kind of the starting point of my own journey into DNA cryptography. And in finding an application, we were inspired by physical unclonable functions. Some of you are perhaps familiar with those. And nowadays, these are pretty common. However, in the early days, they were operating on a much more conceptual level. And the idea was that they would be able to implement something like a cryptographic hash function in a physical systems rather than a mathematical algorithm. And in this first paper, they used a random token. In this case, it was a hardened epoxy with randomly embedded glass spheres. And when they shone a laser onto that token, it would generate a diffraction pattern. And from this 2D speckle, they could then extract a key, a digital key. And this key would be specific to the combination between the random token and the incident angle of the laser. And in that, they were able to kind of calculate inputs or outputs from inputs. However, these outputs could not really be predicted due to the random microstructure, and it was also basically impossible to invert. So we were inspired by this, and we went ahead and thought, okay, maybe we can implement this as a chemical function using these DNA pools. And we wanted our system to also be able to generate these challenge response pairs in a robust manner, and also have a similar level of hardness or irreversibility to it. And the idea we came up with was first manufacturing those random pools. And remember, the randomness is so vast that we cannot, or at least not with reasonable cost, know what all of these sequences are. However, what we can still do is perform PCR on it. And this kind of comprises the operation of the function. And in our case, the input for the function is a primer pair, a PCR primer pair. And this primer pair, even in this vast random background, will find its perfect match, its puzzle piece, and then copy this puzzle piece or this fitting DNA over the background, and this is then our output from which we can extract a key. And so the way you can imagine this on an abstract level is you have a system of which you don't know the composition, but you can still query it with the task of finding all the strings that start with ABC and end with XYZ, and still get a response. And I won't go into too much data or detail with data, but we are able to measure these challenge response pairs. So on the left, you just see a tiny fraction of the pool sequenced before ever entering a challenge. So that is random. And then if we do add challenges, specific patterns emerge. And these patterns are different between different challenges. However, they are with some noise, but they are reproducible through different runs. Now, you may be thinking, okay, so this is maybe just another physical unclonable function. Or what's the difference? And the difference is that a pool of molecules behaves differently than a macroscopic object. And the chemical reactions that we perform sort of make the pool expire, or they alter it in a way that it cannot be retrieved in the same composition after the reaction. And if we want this to work as a function repeatedly, that is a problem, right? And the way we solve this is using some chemical tricks. We can, in the manufacturing stage, first make sure that we have several copies available of the same pool, again, without knowing what we're actually copying, and then performing another chemical step to kind of lock it in place. And with that, I mean that from this point forward, it will no longer be possible to use the same mechanism of copying the pool. And this means we can make it a feature. We can now distribute the same random pool to multiple users and define the rough amount of operations in advance, as every operation will use up a part of the pool. And this then opens opportunities for decentralized applications, which are not possible using puffs, because they are all about having this single 3D object. And this is just one possible scenario where multiple users have the same pool available and are then able to, for example, authenticate each other or just generally generate the same key together. And again, I want to come back to DNA of things, because of course this distributability doesn't only go for multiple users, but again, we can also embed it into materials. And here you see an idea how to authenticate artworks, where we would, for example, integrate a chemical unclonable function into a pigment, then use that to paint an artwork. And if we want to authenticate that, we can simply take a tiny little sample of the paint, measure the challenge response pair, then compare the response to a reference, and we will know without a doubt that this is the artwork painted by a given artist, for example. And this also extends for other materials. So something that we've actually showed in a proof of concept is mixing the chemical unclonable functions with an oral pharmaceutical as an anti-counterfeit measure. Now, of course, we're still a few steps away from this really being implemented on a large scale. And this brings me to my final point, and that is kind of an outlook, or perhaps even the challenges or opportunities that this field still faces. And when staying in the security realm, I think we just really need to understand and characterize these better. We need to develop frameworks and standards. We need to test them. Then, of course, improve the system, develop new ones. I have a few ideas myself, but I'm sure there are people out here with even better ones. And generally, I think the field of DNA information storage needs a few more technological improvements to just make it more practical and cost-effective. And I think it's the perfect field to illustrate how much of an interdisciplinary effort this needs. So we really need experts from various fields, people who are hands-on in the lab, but also people with a hacker's mindset who are willing to tackle these challenges. And in the interest of having enough time for questions, I will keep the conclusions very, very short. But I hope I was able to, at the very least, convince you that molecular information technology deserves our attention as a future tool in data storage and security. And I hope I was able to unlock some new knowledge, inspiration, and maybe even some secrets to be discovered in DNA. Thank you very much.
With this, we have plenty of time for some questions. So first, to the Signal Angel, are there some questions from the internet?
Yes, the internet is having a somewhat complicated discussion about the correspondence between integrating DNA into, for example, STL objects and making this into a somewhat of an evolutionary concept where, for example, you start losing STL parts corresponding to the DNA that's encoded in them. What do you think about this? Is this at all realistic to think it out now?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting and also a fun question to think about. I had some ideas like this myself of kind of making maybe some type of art project like this, where then the shapes or, yeah. However, I think some of these mutations that would occur I think you would be more likely to actually lose data. And this is something that I didn't really mention, but usually when we store any type of digital data in DNA, we also employ error correction. Because otherwise you will just not be able to fully read back your file. I would be interested in this discussion. I think it wouldn't be as easy to implement because the process of data processing and loss in an inanimate object would be different than in the process of life. I don't know if I answered the question with this, but these are some quick thoughts.
With this, there are plenty of questions in the room, so I would ask you to keep for short questions. First with microphone 3.
Hello. I have a question about ethical aspects about DNA storage.
Yes. Well, personally, my approach there is that as long as we don't, I'm very skeptical of editing DNA in, you know, in humans or in any life form. And this is, again, my very personal view. I'm also skeptical about DNA watermarking, for example, that is used to tag or protect artificially generated or modified life forms, for example, for IP reasons, for example. However, I think as long as we just use DNA as an artificial material, we just use the DNA code, the chemical composition of DNA, and not actually people's DNA, I think that can be defended. However, I also believe that the discussion is an important one to have.
I have one more quick question. Is it like RNA and other forms like microDNA is considered to store data or just DNA at the moment?
Well, I think DNA is just the one that makes the most sense for various reasons. One of them is stability, because it's a double strand, and with RNA is just a lot less stable, not just because it's a single strand, but also because it has this additional hydroxyl group that makes it more prone to hydrolysis. And then other biomolecules, such as proteins, for example, they just lack, or if not totally lack, there is at least fewer enzymatic tools we can work with. So, for example, we cannot copy a protein from a protein directly. We have to kind of translate it back and then resynthesize it. And this is why DNA is considered to have the biggest potential.
Thank you very much.
Microphone 1.
Thanks a lot for your talk. Can you tell us more about the expected processing times for the DNA functions mentioned and maybe how expensive it is?
Mm-hmm. I mean, this will or would depend on the scale at which you perform it. Because the reactions we do, they tend to have more of a cost per reaction and not really per sequence we read directly, or at least it's not a linear calculation. But for these operations, so one single challenge response pair generation, at the moment, it takes a few hours, and then we have to sequence the results, which again takes a few hours. So you would have, if you want to authenticate a pharmaceutical, you would have to essentially wait a day. That's where we stand at the moment. Yeah.
Microphone 2.
Hi, thank you for the great talk. I have a question about the storage aspect. In the human body, we have very compact DNA, right? So that it's highly dense chromatin. When you use it as a storage medium, do you do that artificially? So do you do even more compaction, or is it like a natural thing? I don't know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think, of course, the storage densities I mentioned are the theoretical storage densities. the way we do it is we actually only synthesize very short fragments. So in contrast to our chromatin, where you essentially have a 2 meter long strand of DNA, we only synthesize up to a few hundred base pairs, and then we add identifiers at either end to then stitch together the information. If we were to store longer sequences, first of all, we would not be able to synthesize sequences that long. And then also, yeah, you're making an important point, because without the chromatin, there are shear forces, then we would essentially break our DNA and lose it. So this is the way we solve it.
Thanks.
Microphone 4.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the talk. I have a question concerning the copy and lock mechanism. So a naive idea that came to my mind was to just throw in an abundance of all possible short combinations and hope for the best, so to say. Is it possible, or?
Yeah, yes, I've tried and I didn't succeed. I think the problem there is kind of searching or copying something random with something random doesn't really work, because then the primers, so essentially the reaction doesn't really take place. The primers bind to each other. The sequences, they auto-amplify. And of course, we also have, when operating the function, we have similar side reactions, but in that case, they're just not really relevant, because the correct process will take over through the exponentiality. But that way, essentially, you end up destroying your pool or at the very least introduce extreme bias if you manage, rather than actually faithfully copying it.
Thank you.
Microphone 3.
Thanks for the talk. What are the bandwidth limitations of encoding and decoding DNA physically?
Ooh, you would have to ask an information theorist about this. This is really not my area of expertise.
One again.
Hello. I will try to make up my words as fast as possible. But I am wondering, for example, DNA, the essentialist understanding or encodings of DNA has been such a tool to oppress racialized bodies or gendered bodies or different species. So I'm wondering how this kind of randomness that we can build, or like, I don't know, what you're talking can contribute to understanding of identity, or what happens to identity when we think of the essentialist use of DNA.
Yeah, it's hard to answer such a question on the spot. Yeah. I have had similar discussions before also with, bias in PCR, where people have asked similar questions. But again, I think this would be kind of an ongoing thought process to integrate this into the way or these essentialist views where you see DNA. And again, it's not my field of research,
I can only allow, unfortunately, only for one more question. Then the afters you have to get after the talk. So microphone 2.
Hello, I was wondering about the anti-counterfeiting mechanism you presented. In what you presented, what would prevent an attacker from scraping the DNA of an original, sequencing it, and then recloning it?
Yeah. Two things, actually. So for sequencing, you still need to be able essentially to kind of, first of all, to ligate some adapter sequences to the DNA. All technologies we have available today require some kind of what we call library prep. And our chemical modification prevents that attaching process. So if you're able to sequence it, again, we've done our best that it's not possible at all. But then even if you sequence it, then you would have to spend, I think we calculated this to be billions of dollars in in resynthesizing all these strands, because there is this massive asymmetry I talked about. By if you just sequence at random, you can generate many, many different sequences combinatorially. But if you want to synthesize them in a sequence determined way, then you would have to perform one synthesis for each of the strands and then mix them back together. And essentially, this is what would prevent the attacker from doing that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're out of time. If on the way out you want to pass by and get some stickers, they are kind of a Sunday 2 a.m. in the morning design, but I did spray them with DNA with the letters 39C3 in them. So if you want some DNA stickers, come and get some.